Well, so according to the custom of our retreat, during our Saturday evening, we've often passed it with poetry, sometimes with music. And this year I want to share with you readings from a new book of mine. And but before I do that, I wanted to share with you a little bit about what it was like to be in Rome for the death of John Paul II and for the election of Benedict XVI. And I put some photos on the back that I'd like to share, the nice story that goes with that photo, with a series of photos. It was like about 45 seconds with the Pope, but they have a professional photographer there that clicks the whole while, and you can buy the pictures afterwards that I can almost, if you look at the pictures, can tell you just what was said in every moment. It was a great encounter, but I'll come to that in a minute. You know that I've been going back and forth to Rome for many years. I first went for the first time in 1980, and I've been going on and off since then. I think if you added up all the time, maybe I've spent 9 or 10 years of the last 25 in Rome. And so it's a city I know and love. I was certain that I just wouldn't be there when the Pope died and when another one would be elected, you know, which is always an interesting time in the life of the city. People love the Pope, and it's a great sense of loss when a Pope dies, and a great sense of God's being with the Church when a new Pope is elected. And I thought, it would just be the case, you know, that even though I'm in Rome often, it won't happen when I'm there. And I remember when John Paul II was very sick and people said he was dying, I said, he won't die until after July the 10th. But he died on the Sunday after Easter. And he died a very beautiful death. And it was remarkable to feel the energy of the city around his death. When he died, and when word was out that he was dying, St. Peter's Square below his window filled with people praying for him. And he was told that. He said something to the effect of, he said, you know, I always came for you, and now you've come for me. Thank you. And to see that relationship between the people and their shepherd, well, it was a beautiful expression. Also amazing that the city filled up with some 5 million outsiders, people who don't live there, to come for his funeral. And which is, just on a logistic level for any city, is something quite challenging. And I think, you know, often know that we in the States think, oh, Italians, it must be sheer chaos. It isn't. They just speak more loudly than we do. But actually, Rome is an incredible city for its capacity to organize. But even they were astonished at how well it went. To have 5 million people in the city for an extra week, and to really have had virtually no incident of trouble in that whole time. And you felt this energy of the city filling up and of nowhere. Everywhere you went, there was this. I wasn't able to go to his funeral. It's because I didn't feel entirely well, and it would mean standing in crowds for hours and all that. But in a sense, was happy to be able to follow the funeral on television. And I went down to the square a number of times to pray with the people that were doing honor to his body. I was luckier, however, for the election of Benedict, which took place about 3 weeks later. And I had said to my friend, really my best friend in Rome was a Dominican from Ireland, Father Paul Murray. The cardinals had gone into conclave, and of course the whole city was thinking, I think the whole world was thinking, see, who will be elected Pope? And we couldn't. we were trying to carry on with school, and all the students' minds were on it and everything. And it hadn't, there hadn't been a papal election for 28 years. And everyone had heard, but no one's memory was fresh of when the smoke is white, the whole city rushes to the square, and everyone wanted to be there, you know. And yet life had to go on. It could have gone on, the election could have gone on for days or even weeks. And so we were just wondering when it would happen. And I remember telling my students, I said, now, if there's white smoke when I'm lecturing, we're going. And I thought, you know, they would go whether I said they could or not, so I might as well for taking charge. In fact, it didn't happen during one of my classes, but it did happen during other professors' classes, and they said, no, no, we're not going. It's crazy, you know. And the students just got up and left, so much for authority. Wisely. Anyhow, I said to my friend Paul the afternoon that it turned out he was elected, I said, it's too early for the election, but let's go have a walk to St. Peter's. And I said, you know, we'd see black smoke, you know, the custom of black smoke or white smoke. And so I said, just seeing black smoke is interesting, you know. Let's go and feel the energy of the square. And we got there, and there were a lot of people there, but there was no election expected. And so we know our way around Roman crowds. And I have a principle which says, when you're around the Vatican and kind of getting into places you're not supposed to, the principle is, go until you're stopped. And I've actually gone far that way. So Father Paul and I were just going forward in the piazza, you know, past crowds. And there were various barriers and things and people on the other side of them. And we just kept going and going and going. And we were way up then toward the front of the piazza. And if there would have been an election, we were really right under the balcony on which the Pope is presented, maybe 10 rows back. And I thought, you know, we'll wait here for a couple hours. And my legs were sore, and I'd have been having trouble with them, but I thought, you know, I just have to do this. Ooh, we found a whole bunch of chairs there. And people were saying, you know, who are these chairs for? And I said, go until you're stopped, sit down. We sat down and sort of, you know, we're feeling the mood, but we've been there only maybe 25, 30 minutes. And this smoke starts coming out, and the people were on their feet and trying to tell what color it was. And it seemed not white, but it seemed not black. And so there was this tremendous speculation going, and no one could tell what color it was. And we thought, well, there's no election, because they'd said, for sure, they've got a method to make sure the smoke is white. We haven't done it for 28 years, but if it's supposed to be white, it'll be white, and you'll know, well, it wasn't white. So we thought, there's no election. But then a bell is supposed to accompany this as well, a huge bell, which is over on the facade of the basilica. And people were watching to see if that would begin to swing. And I don't know how I knew this, but I was looking at my watch, and I remember it was 6 in the evening. And I thought, I knew that there's a bell that rings at 6 in the evening. And I said, this will be a false alarm. You just watch. I announced it 2 minutes before. And so the bell rang for 6 o'clock hour, and everyone started cheering, and then they realized, oh, it's only 6 o'clock. But then finally that big bell began to swing without sounding, and we knew there was an election. And within 30 minutes, we had to wait about an hour for the new Pope to be presented, and not knowing who it was. And in 30 minutes we could see behind us the entire square filling, with going maybe from 40,000 people to well over a million back there. And people, my friends who weren't as lucky as to be ahead of the game as I was, were coming from across town where we lived, and they said it looked like the end of the world, especially with monks and nuns running through the streets. Traffic jams everywhere, people on buses and jumping off of buses. And everybody just said, well, we've just never had so much fun, which is what it's all about. The city can do that, you know. Rises up as a city with joy and has fun. And eventually the new Pope was presented, and Because in that hour interval, talking to all the people around us, and many of us thought it would be Joseph Ratzinger, and I was, you know, hoping it would be. And I remember saying, if it's Ratzinger, he'll choose the name Benedict. And I had sort of thought that through, but I was also reasoning again, well, if I'm right, they'll be terribly impressed. If I'm wrong, no one will remember. So I said it, and I knew that he was very fond of Saint Benedict and Benedictines, and so I thought that would be, and also that Saint Benedict is the patron of Europe, and it's a big concern of this Pope, the fact that Europe is losing its Christian roots. And I knew that all through his life, he's made that a strong theme of his ministry. And he will make it a strong theme of his papal ministry. And I thought, well, he could signal that by choosing the name Benedict, which he did. So there he walks out, and he's right there, and we're in all the energy of the crowd. It was like the most positive crowd energy you could imagine. I felt so lucky and fortunate to be there. Anyhow, the pictures on the board took place about a little over 2 months later, on July the 6th, just before I left for home on July the 7th. And I think you know that I am on a committee in the Vatican as a theological advisor. The picture of the group that I advise is there, pictured with the Pope. And as a group, we were presented to the Pope at the end of his Wednesday audience. And all the cardinals and bishops in our group went up one by one, and then I was allowed to accompany them. And I had to present myself to the Pope, saying who I was. And he could tell by I was dressed like this that, you know, I wasn't a cardinal or an archbishop. So who's this guy in here with all of them? And so, according to protocol, I kissed his ring, and then I stood up and I said, my name is Father Jeremy Driscoll. I'm from Mount Angel Abbey. No, I said, I'm a Benedictine monk. I said it like that. I said, from Mount Angel Abbey. And there was just a kind of this little twinkle in his eye where he said, you know, I can see that. I know what Benedictines are. You know, but that was the little game at the first. And then I said, I'm also with Vox Clara, which is the name of our committee. So in that way, I explained what I was doing there. And he said to me, oh, Vox Clara. He said, that's important work. Thank you for that. And then it would have been time for me to go or say one thing. And so I thought in advance, what is the one thing I would want to say to the Pope in this moment? And you may be aware that Cardinal Ratzinger was a controversial figure in the church, and some people don't like him and would not have been happy with his election. So with that in mind, I said to him quite honestly and from the depth of my heart, I said, I'm happy you're the Pope. And that's the picture where you see him going, like, you know, you're not really supposed to walk up to the Pope and say whether you're happy or not. So, but he knew what I was. He knew what I was saying, and then I said, "I'm happy you're the Pope," and I said, "I'll pray for you every day." And it was really a wonderful encounter directly with the man, and he just squeezed my hands tighter, and then he said, "Tell me again the name of your monastery," and I felt that's typical of his sense of, you know, where do you come from? Who are you? And the answer would be the name of my monastery. All that was sort of the subtext, you know. And he said, tell me the name of your monastery again. And I said, Mount Angel. And when his hand goes up like that, he said, greet your whole community for me. Mm-hmm. So that was it. And it was a great, great encounter. And I have read him for the last 30 years. And know his thought very well, and feel just so blessed that this man, a man of this quality and caliber, succeeds the great Pope John Paul II. Now, the thing about the monk's alphabet, that's sharing with you something I've been working on for some years. And it's a book I've written, which has a subtitle which has since been changed by the publisher, but I like the subtitle because it explains what monk's alphabet means. Random thoughts of a monk arranged in alphabetical order. What it is it's a genre or a style that that I've seen used elsewhere and that I developed for my own purposes of putting down short thoughts ranging from 5 lines to 100 lines and inviting the reader to read them in any order, but needing to put them in some order, so arranging them in alphabetical order like you would a dictionary. And trying to give them, and the reader will get used to this, I hope, trying to give them intriguing titles where you'll go, after reading several of them, I wonder what he'll say about this. And I've often read to you my poetry in these settings, and this is like poetry, although it's a dense, thick prose. And let me share some of the introduction to you, with you, and then do a sample selection, jumping around like the reader is invited to do. The audience I'm trying to reach here is an audience I haven't written and published for before. I could borrow the title of the 19th century philosopher and theologian Friedrich Schleiermacher, who subtitled one of his works, "For the Cultured Despisers of Religion." You know, it's cool in our culture to think that people who believe in God are dumbos and don't really have thoughts, that they believe in God because they're kind of freaks and afraid. And I understand that that can be a thought and a sentiment, but I want to reach people like that, and I want to reach people that believe as well. And I want to range widely and sometimes talk directly about religious questions and sometimes not talk about them at all. But for people of faith, no matter what you're talking about, faith is transmitted. And that's what I hope will happen in this book. I had to hold out a long time for a publisher that would not treat it as a religious book, but that would, I said basically, I didn't want you to have to come to the Abbey bookstore to buy this book, but you would find it in Barnes & Noble and in airport bookstores. And in the end, I think I landed a deal with a publisher that likes the book at that level and will get it out that way. You can pray with me that that happens, and also kind of pray of protection around the book, because the publisher I have to associate with publishes many things I wouldn't want to be associated with. But they have the distribution that I want. And so I'm risking that and need your prayers to protect it as well. But here's some of the introduction. A monk's day is very regular. Prayer always at the same time and structured in the same way. Reading and work at the appointed intervals. Meals at the customary hour and always taken at the assigned place in the refectory. A predictable diet, always to bed at this hour, always rising from sleep at that hour. The architectural arrangement of the monastery underlines the regularity of these monastic practices. Long corridors uniformly marked by doors to the brethren's cells and to the rooms of common living. It goes on the same one day after another, week after week, for years and years. I've been living in my monastery since 1973. Not much has changed in the way I pass my days. This terrifying regularity is not meant to drive a person mad though it has been known to do so. It is not even meant primarily as a form of asceticism, though it does require a certain sense of discipline. It is not a repudiation of variety as the spice of life, though at first it appears flavorless. Rather, it is designed to set the monk free on a different level of his being, and generally it accomplishes just that. Once used to the exterior routine, the monk is free to live much more readily attuned to an interior life, to a realm in which the life of the mind and the spirit holds sway. Only this can make the monastic life interesting. However boring or exotic its exterior forms may appear at first glance to those who do not practice them, the exotic dimension quickly disappears for those who carry them out day by day. And yet even these dimensions retain a kind of aura for practitioner and observer alike, precisely because they are the concrete forms through which one passes back and forth from one level of life to the other. So monastic life arranges the exterior dimensions of human existence in such a way that its interior dimensions can come more immediately to the fore. This is accomplished by establishing a thoroughgoing regularity to the exterior shape of each day. But the life of the spirit, the inner life which emerges, is anything but regular, anything but predictable. It may well be too chaotic and lead to a crash. Yet, in most cases, guided by the wisdom embodied in a vast tradition handed down by monks of former generations, the interior life which unfolds produces a variety which is indeed the spice of life. What people see outwardly of a monk's life might lead them to expect that things would be different, that a monk's inner life would be dull and plain. With this book, I want to testify, not for me it isn't. With this book, I want to share some of my life. Not because there is anything especially interesting about me, but because the life of the mind and spirit is interesting. I feel the privilege of being able to live in such a way, and I want to bear witness to it. Then I go on explaining how the alphabet will work and what the precedents in tradition are. There really are books like this that go back some 2,000 years, and I'm following that. And then the reader will see a list of about 190 entries. And you just see the contents of the book in terms of one-line titles. I'll just read some of what the titles are, which I hope will just interest you. And just wondering, what's he going to say about that? I won't read them all, but going from A through, first entry is Airplane, Anniversary. Baghdad, Beethoven, Benedict, Clumsy, Creation, Crowds, Cruelty, Density, Design, Dying, Equinox, Eschatology, Faith, 50s, First Love, Good Friday, Gypsy, Hallelujah, Humility, Instruments, Colby, Little Things, Midlife, Mosquitoes, Muzzle, O'Keefe, Pacific Ocean, Peninsula, Priest, Processions, Relativity, Restless, Roar, Soul, Streets, Style, Swinging, Three, Tremendous, United, Wager, Weather, X-ray of a Cherry, Zacchaeus, Zare, and so forth. So, I'll read you some of those. I say you can read them in any order, like a dictionary, but some of the readers who helped me with this said, you know, yes, but people will start on the first page a lot, so you got to get a good start. And then I realized I needed to get, I actually, in the end, wove a sort of text all the way through in case someone read it from start to finish, and making sure that it could read well from start to finish. And actually, I found it sort of fun that you could move, I could move whole texts I'd written by simply changing the title. And the title wasn't always crucial. So it's been just a joy to write in that sense. But here's Airplane, and it would be the first entry you'd come across. The wintry night is cold and clear. I finish singing Compline with my monastic community and step out into the garden where, far from city lights, I look up into the sky and see the million stars. Verses from the Psalms still move in me. He who dwells in the shelter of the Most High, the Lord who made heaven and earth, I will lie down in peace. In the stars I see moving fast among them a jet plane and think with affection of its cargo of passengers. I am able to imagine from my own flying how different the same moment is for them, different from my quiet garden. They speed along somewhere, probably a little cramped and uncomfortable, and yet for all that, what they are doing is amazing. They travel at great speed to a desired faraway destination, and given the circumstances, there is relative comfort. The terrible cold is shut out, as well as the night. They can listen to music, watch a movie, drink wines from another continent, do remarkable calculations and other work on their computers. As a Benedictine monk, I live a tradition that is 1,500 years old, but I'm not living in another time different from my own. This is my century, too. I travel in planes, see the movies, use a computer. It makes me think about how I think. The monastic environment, in fact, offers unique advantages for thinking in a particular way. This environment and these advantages are certainly linked to a tradition, indeed to a very old one. And yet at the same time, the one thinking, in this case me, is also a product of and a player in his own times. That is, he is involved in the kind of world of which jet travel may serve as an emblem. So like any other person living in our times, the monk is potentially a partner and a player in a cultural dialogue. He is not disqualified by the ancient traditions to which he adheres. In this fact, among other things, we have in monastic life a clear example of how any tradition works. Traditions are not lived for their own sake. They are valued and live when they are thought to contain a wisdom still useful for our present and future. I am willing to live according to the 1,500-year-old rule of Saint Benedict because I believe it contains a wisdom useful not only for me, but for my companions, my race, with whom I live this present period of human history. I got to find some shorter ones because there are lots of those too, and just to have the feel of that. I'd like to read you Roar, R-O-A-R, Roar. The ancient Romans thought of a crowd roaring as an awesome and mysterious moment. An eerie demon of unanimity, suddenly and unpredictably, sweeps through thousands of different people all at once and binds them into a same emotion, causing to rise up from them this huge sound as evidence of its presence. And just as quickly, the phantom departs, though the sense of its presence and the emotion linger. We are no longer inclined to consider a crowd's roar in these terms. But isn't something needed to urge us to experience with greater wonder such an amazing phenomena, and to give us some means of measuring its mystery? There we all are. Though part of a crowd, each is in his own little interior enclosure, until suddenly we are all together and all at once on our feet and roaring sounds. Sounds unintelligible in themselves, but forming together a great expression of unity and communion, which most certainly is peculiar to our race, and to which there is nothing comparable among the other animals active on this planet. Would that God himself might suddenly sweep through the crowd of humanity gathered in the arena of the world, and we, all of us together, would roar our excitement and gratitude at the unexpected communion brought on by this unexpected visit. Here's one called Germs. We moderns tend to scoff at the credulity of the ancients who so readily believed in the presence of throngs of demons and angels invisibly surrounding them, anxious to help or harm, very much involved in their world. But how is it that we are so certain of the presence of incalculable numbers of dangerous, invisible bacteria all around us and everywhere? Germs everywhere? Really? What faith? When he was 93 years old and not far from death, Father Martin said to me, "It's no good waiting forever." He meant that he was ready to get on with it, ready to die. Shortly after, he looked up and, reflecting on time stretching itself out in the way that it does, he said, "I came to love you more and more." Then, turning back to the prospect of his death, he said, "It's like being thrown out of an airplane in the dead of night. You have no idea where you'll land. All you can do is receive the sacraments and hope for the best." You don't think that shakes you from a wise old monk? Mosquitoes. The mosquitoes. There are probably billions of mosquitoes in any given season around Earth, and yet there are probably more stars. And when you think of how much is going on in and around a star, even a fairly average one like our sun, then to consider that there are more of these massive, complex stars than the endless parade of comparatively less complex, tiny mosquitoes on any given summer night in just one place where I am. Well, then I ask, where on Earth are we when we are in the universe? Muzzle. The dog I had as a boy stood at a height where her muzzle was level with my bed. This made for effective early morning communication. I could easily be informed when she wanted me awake and up. Her wet muzzle would be jabbed into my face, accompanied by the dog equivalent of what we humans call whining. Then she would step back slightly and move her feet rapidly up and down in place, making a clicking sound with her claws on the tile floor. The first jab would inevitably wake me. She would observe closely the telltale signs. Then I would always feign sleep, and the evident lie frustrated her. The next jab would be preceded by whines and the clicking paws. She would come in harder the second time and also begin to lick. I would shift a little, trying to lend some credulity to my fake sleep. But she knew, and she knew I knew she knew. Suppressed whines, continued clicking. I would eventually turn and look her in the eye. Her entire being began to wiggle with the joy of a new day and of our being together. This has had a profound effect on my life, and I want to bear testimony to it. One of my earliest strong thoughts and insights into the world is admiration, not only of the dog and her humor, but also of the divine creator's ingenuity and humor. I am, among other things, placed in relation to all kinds of animals who inhabit this earth with me and want to live here too. They are full of delightful traits, and by means of some of their emissaries, I am united to them all, enjoying the difference and marveling at the possible points of contact. The wet nose on the snout of a dog and her lively eyes at the end of it. The whole animal kingdom comes and calls me awake for another day in this our place. Priest. One evening, Nicholas, age 9, interrupted a dinner conversation that was going in quite another direction and announced, "I have a question." Then he turned to me and said, "What's it like as a priest to say the words of Jesus at Mass, 'This is my body'?" I knew that he needed as clear and complete an answer as possible, and that he expected it to be brief. So I told him that you could feel in that moment Christ completely taking possession of you, and that you experience his total love for the people, his desire to give every bit of himself for their well-being. You feel it especially for the people that are there in the church. But you know also that this love is for the whole world, for everybody, and for everything in the world. In another direction, you also feel in yourself Christ's love for his Father, burning like a roaring furnace. You understand that the reason he is offering his body and blood is because in this way he wants to honor his Father. He knows that the Father wants him to offer himself for the world in this way, and he gladly does it. So full of love is he. I could see that Nicholas was made happy by this answer. The smile that spread quietly across his face when I had finished betrayed a wonderful understanding, a kind of knowing satisfaction, almost a, "Yes, I thought so." He had told me the week before, with tears in his eyes, that he wants to be a priest when he grows up. Raisa. I felt myself cooled by the shade the trees of green and the other greens by which I was surrounded. Cedar, fir, oak, fig, mint, blackberry, lawn. It was Sunday afternoon, and I was reading Raisa's journal, Raisa Maritain, under the cedar tree, just next to Brother Claude's icon studio. Raisa. There are several pictures of her in the book, one where she has just turned 20. She is beautiful, a bright soul shining in a young face. And this visual image subtly accompanies my reading, my letting myself be led by her thoughts. Suddenly, I hear a loud, clumsy, thrashing sound coming from the grotto below me to my left, out of sight. I stand up to look and spot a deer, a doe, and in the same instant, she spots me and so fixes me and herself. I match her stillness and stare. We are two animals, suddenly brought together. There is no hostility, though there is caution, more from her part, of course, than from mine. She is the first to move, and when she sees that I don't, she is calmed. Eventually, she climbs to the rim of the grotto, all the while keeping me in her sight. In her new position, I see that by moving only my head, I will put a tree trunk between myself and her line of vision. I make my move, and she immediately stretches her neck round the other side of the trunk. I am seen again. I move back. So does she. And so on. 5 or 6 times. I set a slow rhythm, 20 seconds or more between each shift. What absorbing theater. This was a game you don't get to play very often. There was for me an unusual joy in it. But more, I felt simply the deep mystery of another living being. A being for whom eye contact with me was at that moment absolutely vital. She stares at me from a certain distance. The doe, Raisa, being itself. There is a distance and a certain caution, but I connect. Here, under the shade of a cedar tree in the thick summer. I should read you Beethoven. This would be an example of one of the things I hope to do often in the alphabet is you see a title like Beethoven, and when you're done, you say, well, I didn't think it was going to be about that. This would be one of the better examples of that, I hope. Beethoven. When I was 19, I had a summer job as a cowboy in New Mexico. I went with 3 friends, none of whom, like me, knew much about serious riding and work with cattle. But we went to learn, ready for the adventure. We were trained in our new skills by riding alongside real cowboys, both boys and men who had been raised in that land and for that work. Riding home at the end of the day, there would often be long hours of banter. We were amused by the real cowboys, and they were amused by us. The banter would often include the rubric of insulting the horse that the other one was riding that day. You were expected to defend your own horse and trash the others. Some new horses had recently been added to our herd and were without names. We saw that these horses would eventually be dubbed according to what they revealed of themselves after several days of riding. And so our horses had names like Dime, short for diamond, Dent, caught in barbed wire and so putting a dent in his flank, Flash, who was fast, and other such names usually of one syllable. One of our new horses was an impressive bay with beautiful proportions of the black markings on brown that characterize this breed. My three friends and I took to calling him Beethoven to honor his beauty, to suggest that there was strong music in his gait. The real cowboys heard with curiosity our three-syllable name for the splendid steed. And in the banter coming home one late afternoon, Beethoven's rider, clearly unaware of the famous musician of the same name, asked me, "Why are you calling my bay Beethoven?" The muse of banter entered me in a flash, and I thought in that moment, sweetly inspired to say, "Because a Toven is a no good horse, and you're riding a bay, so it's a Beethoven." He didn't know the word Toven. And fair enough, for as I say, it had only just then been invented. But he immediately responded, "Well, it's a bay, but it ain't no Toven." For the rest of the summer, Toven was a word in our banter vocabulary. We all came to use it in the varying contexts in which there was reason to criticize a horse. I've often wondered if the word might still be in use in that region. I imagine some future entry in a dictionary. Toven, a flawed horse, regional only, Southwest USA, origin unknown. Let me read you a thread. Thread. I have this image while I pray. What God has done in Jesus, hanging as a thin thread from top to bottom of the whole universe. It appears frail and dimensionless, without color and virtually invisible. Still it is there, even if surrounded all around by the vast space of earth, by the endless space of the regions beyond. I reach out and touch this thread. That's all there is to do with it. It's not a rope you can grab onto and climb up with. You can only touch it, feel it against your hand. But surprisingly, something comes from this. I touch it, move it a little, and some new something comes into me, some new life, a new seeing. I don't go up on it, I don't go down on it, I don't go anywhere. But when I touch it, I feel a connection. I'm touching it now. I'm feeling against my hand something which, by comparison with the substantial things all around me, hardly exists. And yet a power comes from this touch. It is as if, virtually unnoticed, no more than the slight movement of a thread, the door to an entirely new dimension cracks open, and I find myself standing within it. I don't know how. I am in the same place. I see all the same things around me. I am still me, and I must face the day. But a bit of understanding begins to emerge, and some sense to it all. As improbable as it seems, I dare to think that I may now be connected with God, even in a kind of intimacy. How exactly, I can't say. I can only bear witness to this marvelous surprise. When I touch this thread, I feel a great connection. Then the connection fades. So I reach out and touch it again. Again, I am connected. I can read you two entries that connect with the stories I told you about being in Rome at this special time. One is called Swinging. Life would be dreary without all the things that swing. Votes swing and people get elected. Music swings and the big band's notes are smooth. I swing and it means that I'm lively and up to date. But swinging's best sense has to do with physical things. That to and fro movement, that swaying, that oscillating tracing of some invisible curve that pulls a thing so far this way and then sends it back so far the other. When as a boy I was placed in a seat slung by ropes on a tree's branch and set to swing, swinging that way was like joining the world. I already somehow knew that the world was moving and that I was meant to move too. But I didn't yet know about rhythms, limits, momentum, gathering speed, directions, and their opposites. Swinging teaches a lot of this, even if not all. Some of the most heart-rending swinging I've ever seen was when Pope John Paul II died. His corpse was being carried on a bier through the Vatican Palace and into St. Peter's Square. All the while, the litany of the saints was being sung. The names of holy men and women called out and then beseeched one by one to pray for him. Rhythm, momentum, the to and fro between heaven and earth. But as I say, swinging's best sense has to do with physical things. And what really made this litany and procession so remarkable was the unexpectedly slow and exactly coordinated constant swinging of the outer arm of each of four Swiss guards who framed and walked alongside the bier. Invisible curve traced again and again, forward and back, the four corners of the earth quietly secured. Haunting, swinging rhythm that together with the holy chants was steadily, unexpectedly slowly, carrying a beloved man from one world to the next. A memory flashed of myself as a boy on a swing, and I thought, surely the dead man had once enjoyed the same. Here we are in life and death, swinging. This is called White. White smoke from the chimney on the Sistine Chapel indicates to people gathered in St. Peter's Square that a new pope has been elected by the cardinals gathered in conclave. John Paul II added something new to this tradition when he decreed that in the election that would follow his death, the huge bell on the left side of the facade of St. Peter's Basilica should be rung, proclaiming in its own way what the white smoke declares. All of us who were gathering in the square when the election of Benedict XVI was announced could not tell for sure if the smoke was really white. It seemed black and then gray at best, but it kept vigorously puffing away. People would shout, "It's black," then "It's white," But it was never really white. It was just only sometimes not black. This was a unique tease, incredibly dramatic. Where do you ever get a black and white question posed like this? As we continued watching and trying to decide, we inevitably kept turning toward the bell to see if it would start to move. If it did, then we would know what color the smoke was. Finally, at first nearly imperceptibly, the mighty bell began to stir. That faintly discernible movement raised an enormous roar of excitement in the huge crowd. The bell could gather its momentum only slowly, so massive and heavy was it. So there it was, swaying, swinging, but not yet sounding, gathering its drive. And it seemed our shouting was gradually lengthening the reach of its thrust. At last, its deep tone sounded, and the sound propelled the movement into ever wider arcs in both directions of its sweep. Other bells swung into the song as the wide arms of the square embraced the gathering throng. I do not mean to recount here all the details of that exciting hour. I only mean to utter a small testimony as to how beautiful at first was that swinging, silent bell. So, one or two more. Oyster. If I declare that the world is my oyster, that means I'm at home in it and find it full of desirable things and people, that I'm here to enjoy myself. So, is that something that I, as a monk, can say? Is the world my oyster? Joining a monastery is not the usual response of someone who discerns the world as his oyster. For me, in fact, things worked rather the other way around. To my surprise, my cloister has taught me to feel at home in the world. Life in this world, with all it casts up before us for our enjoyment, is this not something truly wondrous and to be grateful for, even if it is not my only home and does not define my entire destiny? All the same, there is a deeper advantage to the oyster association. The original expression can be traced back to Shakespeare. In The Merry Wives of Windsor, Pistol, in answering Falstaff, exclaims, "Why then, the world's mine oyster, which I with sword will open." In Shakespeare's time, cutting open an oyster was an image for laying difficult matters bare. May I dare to claim Pistol's image to describe my reflections here? It is what I am attempting. That is, if not entirely to lay bare, then at least to pry open a little some of the difficult, mysterious, beautiful matters of the world. The world, my cloister. A splendid pearl. I'll finish with the last paragraph of the introduction. Well, I better finish with the last two, sorry. Just to give you context. I talk about this unvarying routine in the introduction, but I needed to deal with this as well because of so many of the injuries. Before I begin, I must also confess to something. This is the end of the introduction. Although the theme of the unvarying routine of monastic life has deeply marked my own during more than three decades, I have also lived through a series of circumstances which contradict in part this supposed exterior monotony. My monastery is in Oregon, in a relatively remote rural scene. It was there that I settled down into the monastic way. But during many years, I have also been assigned to study and teach in Rome, at a school where Benedictine monks do just that. In the center of the city, in this case Rome, the regular routine of the rural monastery is able to come less to the fore. For more than 10 years now, I have gone back and forth, half the year in the country, half the year in the city. Ah, well, there is ample monastic precedent also for this. For me personally, this has been tremendously enriching. From the peace of my rural scene, I am thrust into the heart of the city. From the edge of America, I am cast into a center of Europe. But wherever I am, I always feel myself guided and provoked by the monastic traditions I live. I am a monk wherever I am. But if I am a monk, that means that I am also just a man, connected with all other men and women in my time and in other times. I'm searching, like we all do. I struggle to believe, like we all do. Life is lonely. Life is hard. This is true for me, like it is for us all. That is why I think to share my alphabet. Not because monks are different and so worth a visit to see them in a zoo, but because my monastic life has given me the space to think about things that we all care about and all have to face. Life poses huge questions, terrible questions, glorious questions. We must face them. Avoiding them makes us dangerous and makes the world go crazy. What is offered here is provisional. There is nothing normative in what is provisional. In the midst of my going on, I turn at any random moment to any random person who might be interested in joining the search. I turn and I say, "Oh, think about this with me." So, thanks for your good attention.